This is Alan Etchells, recorded at his home in Ellesmere Port by Chris Eldon Lee on Monday the 15th of June 2009. Alan Etchells, Part 1.
William Alan Etchells, 17th of May 1928.
Where were you born?
Furness Vale, near Welly Bridge in Derbyshire.
Okay. And what kind of schooling did you have?
Just elementary, really. Left school at 14 and started work.
What was your first job, Alan?
In a machine shop. They made dynamos. Well, small ones to big ones. Doing assembly work, really, and lathe work for about 18 months.
Was engineering in the family blood somewhere, or was it?
No, it wasn't really. No. My dad worked on the railway. He was a shunter and a guard and a yard inspector. And a lot of the others, uncles, and seemed to be carpenters for some reason. I don't know why. Go on. It must have been the trade at the time, sort of thing.
Yeah. Were you perceived as a bright lad at school?
Now, but average, or less.
I'm proud of it.
Yeah. No, it was during the war, and there wasn't a lot of schooling, really, and no sport or anything.
Yeah. But so you don't know where the interest in engineering came from? There was no Meccano kits as a kid, or?
Oh, yeah, Meccano kits and things like that, yeah, but it doesn't mean to say you're going to go into engineering side, does it, really?
Were you happy as an engineer?
Oh, yeah, I liked it, actually, yeah.
So how did you first get in contact with Bass?
I was a bit older than most of the people that joined Bass, really. I'd been in the army and come out of there and then been a mechanic again for a number of years.
Doing what?
Just working on private cars and commercial vehicles, really. And I was about 35, I think, before I joined. Before I saw this advert I didn't see it. My mother saw this advert. I think she knew I was getting a bit fed up. She said, "Here, try this." And I applied and got an interview.
Can you remember where the advert was? The newspaper?
Yeah, Express. Really? Daily Express. Just a little advert in the back somewhere.
Saying what?
Well, just that they wanted mechanics and, just that they wanted mechanics to go south and work in the Antarctic for 2 years or so.
Had you ever thought about the Antarctic prior to that?
Not really, no. Not until then, no. So I read a couple of books, find out what it was about.
Oh, you did read?
I did read then, yeah.
What did you read, remember?
Well, Fuchs's book, the obvious one, Crossing the Antarctic. And I don't know what else it was.
Did he inspire you, Vivian Fuchs?
Well, yeah, he was that sort of person, I suppose, really. It was the days of the great explorers, really. Well, I suppose it had come to an end then, but he was one of the last ones, really. Yeah.
So you fancied yourself down south, did you?
Well, I didn't know much about it, really. I mean, you don't know what you're going to find down there, really.
So when you went to the interview, I guess that was in London.
Yeah.
And they said the classic question, why do you want this job? What might you have said?
I don't know, I might have said I'm short of cash, you know. Although he didn't get much in those days. I mean, it was used to get 500, no, 450 for a year. If you signed up for 2 years, you got 500 for each year.
You're giving me the impression you just kind of fell into it.
Well, yeah, pretty well, yeah. I didn't know what to expect at all, really.
They didn't warn you?
Well, no, they'd already recruited a lot of people and somebody had dropped out. And that's why they put this advert in.
Right.
And they'd already had a conference. They have a conference in Cambridge where everybody gets together. Everybody that's going down to the Antarctic, you get to know one another and they have lectures and all sort of thing. But I missed all that. So first time I met anybody was going down to Southampton and getting on the ship.
And what year was this, Alan?
62.
Right.
And November 62. Well, December, I think we saw. December the 5th, something like that.
A lot of people I interview are surprised at how short a time there was between getting the job and going south, and it sounds like you also.
Yeah. Well, I think it was because this person, whoever it was, had dropped out, sort of thing, and they needed another one, somebody to replace him.
Did you get any sense that they were asking questions about your personality, how you would cope with being locked away for 12 months or...?
I don't think so. I can't remember them asking them sort of questions, no. There was three people, Bill Sloman, Johnny, no, that's wrong. Who was the other bloke?
Maurice Sumley.
No, before him.
John Green.
They don't matter, really. And the engineer from Crown Agents.
Oh, right. What do you make of Bill Sloman?
Oh, you're a fantastic bloke, yeah. Yeah, very nice.
Why? In what way?
He was just a gentleman. He just treated everybody so good, really. And did a lot for, well, quite a lot of us, really.
So he didn't just appoint you and then forget about you?
Oh, no. He used to go down on the ships any case. And one thing about him, he had these crib cards which told him everybody's name and which base we were on, all the rest of it. And he used to look at these before he got to a base. And then he'd get off the ship and meet somebody, say, "Hello, Fred," sort of thing, you know. And they'd say, "I wonder how he knows me."
You saw these cards, didn't you?
Yeah. I used to carry them all the time, yeah.
Were they a closely guarded secret, or was it obvious?
Well, I don't think many people knew, but later on I saw them when I was part of HQ, yeah.
Did you ever see your own card?
No, not really, no. No, I didn't. I didn't really look for that, no. Perhaps I should have done.
No, you're the first person to mention that. That answers.
Well, perhaps nobody knows.
Answers some questions about how he could do that.
Yeah.
Because he was impressive, I gather.
Oh, he was, yeah. Very good. Quite a gentleman, really.
So here you are at Southampton, November 1962, with a ship in front of you.
A little ship, man.
What was it called?
Kistedam, Danish charter ship, on a 100-day charter from UK to UK.
Right. Was this your first time on board ship?
No. I'd been on a ship, troop ship in the army and... various things, yeah.
What did he make of her?
Well, it's all right. Moved about a lot, but it's only small, an icebreaker. But it was quite comfortable, really, yeah.
Were you surprised how small she was, considering how far you were going?
Well, yeah. Because she used to berth in the same dock as the Queen Mary in those days, wasn't it? Queen Mary, yeah. Looked like a lifeboat belonging to the big ship, you know. But in those days, it was treated more as an expedition sort of thing. I mean, people from HQ used to come down and see the ship off and have your photograph taken with Sir Viv and all the rest of it, you know. Which made it quite exciting, I suppose, really.
You felt important?
Well, yeah, a bit, yeah. Yeah, I'm part of this expedition, you know.
And so your first meeting with the rest of the expedition was actually...
on the ship, yeah.
In Southampton.
Yeah. And all younger than me. Well, no, except for one. The radio op, he was older than me. What's his name, quick?
Yeah. We're looking at
it's that. Useless. Right. Irish bloke.
The fact you were older, did that matter? Did that make you separate from the rest, or...?
No, not really, no. It didn't seem to matter, no.
Ewell Gorman.
Ewell Gorman, his name, yeah. Yeah. It was him that started off with calling me Dad, actually.
Tell me about that, then, please. What happened?
Well, he didn't want to be known as the oldest on the base, really.
This is...?
He was radio op. He'd been at sea for a long time, and he was... I was 34, I think, at that time. He must have been about getting on for 40, you know. And so someone else started calling me Dad the bloke that worked with me in the garage. And old Gorman heard this and picked it up and pushed it and pushed it and pushed it, you know. So in the end, the name stuck. And it's been Dad ever since.
Did he mind?
No, not really, no, no, no. Everybody had a nickname in any case. It might as well have been Dad as anything else.
Well, it
could have been something else, yeah. Really. Yeah.
Was that nickname used purely in Bass circles, or did it also get into your everyday life back home as well?
Well, it has with Dexfids and all the rest of them. You know, the families, they all know me as Dad, yeah. But not in my family, really, no.
Tell me about your first few days at sea. What do you recall of the passage?
It's quite a long time ago, actually.
Yeah, I know.
Just getting to know the ship, I suppose, really. And being on that Danish ship, we had stewards looking after us. It wasn't like a bass ship sort of thing. We had to do the washing up, but the meal was served by the stewards and they did the cleaning up and all the rest of it. Which was quite good.
But that was a change, I guess, when he got to the Antarctica. Where was the first port of call?
After the Falklands, it would be... I went down to Hope Bay, picked up some dogs, and then South Georgia, right? Pick up the seals after we shot them.
You had to shoot a seal, did you?
Yeah, yeah. And we picked, it was a regular thing, really, picking up seals from South Georgia. We had about 100 of them on the foredeck.
Dead?
Dead and smelling.
Had you shot anything before?
Well, I didn't actually shoot. It was just people off the ship shot them, the crew, bosun and whatever.
I presume that was a bit of a rude awakening, was it?
Yeah, it was a bit, really, yeah. You had to gut them all, yeah. And then towed them out to the ship. And all a bit messy, but everybody was doing it, so, I mean, it was all right.
Did it cross your mind that this was not why you signed up for the job?
Well, no, it was all part of it, really. If you're going to go down to the Antarctic and they're going to run dogs, they need seals, so they've got to get them from somewhere. We had to go around the other side of the bay, though, so that the magistrate's wife wouldn't see us what we were doing. So we were out of sight, sort of thing.
You didn't want to upset nobility?
No, no.
Nevertheless, if they hadn't explained in advance that you'd have to do that, it must have been...
Well, everybody was involved in it. I mean, all the fids on the ship and... were into it, sort of thing. So, you know, it wasn't just you're doing it by yourself. It was new to everybody.
You'd been allocated to Halley, hadn't you?
Yeah.
And you were going to be there for how long?
2 years on base, yeah.
Two winters or one winter?
Two winters, yeah.
So, tell me about your first impressions of Halley in 1963.
Well, it was 63 by the time I got there. Usually, ship got into Halley about 10th of January or something like that. Well, I mean, the first impression was just big cliffs, about 90 foot high. And sea ice in the bay sort of thing, which we tied up to, sure the ship tied up to. So people had to go over the side and dig holes to put the sea ice... they used big timbers, actually. Dug big holes, put the timbers in and put a wire around them and used those as a mooring for the ship.
And would that take a long time?
Well, it took a few hours, yeah. They put you ashore and then they sailed around for a bit, yeah, until we'd got them all in, and then they came back and threw the lines ashore and... tied the ship up.
Oh, right, okay. And then they showed you Halley Base. This would be Halley 1.
Yeah, Halley 1, yeah. Yeah. Well, it was about 2 miles of sea ice and then a ramp up onto the top of the cliffs, and then the base was only about 2 miles away at that time.
So you arrived by sledge, or did you walk?
Oh, sledge. I think we all put on a sledge on it and went up there. But, I mean, you were allocated jobs before that, really. The ship had to be unloaded, and you're all involved in that. And they did working for 24 hours because it was 24-hour daylight. So you were divided into two 12-hour shifts, really. So you didn't see a lot of the base for quite a time.
Days?
Well, I mean, you hit backward and forward, but you hadn't got time to do much. Mm. Just a matter of taking a load up there, unloading, and going back to the ship.
Right.
For the next one.
That was a big job, was it?
Oh, yeah, I went on for about 6 days, I think. 5-6 days.
Where were you putting all the stuff when you got to the base? Leaving it on the...
Well, a lot of it was just laid out on the snow. And marked with stakes to show where it was, in case we got a blow and it disappeared. A lot of the perishables went inside and that sort of thing.
So at some time in that process, you saw your new home?
Oh, yeah,
under
yeah.
Under the ice.
We had a quick look round, yeah.
What were your impressions, Alan? Because this is all...
It's a bit rough, actually.
In what way?
Well, the base had only been built 3 years, I think. But when it was built, they hadn't sent the bolts down to bolt it all together. I forget who built it. Harbrose, I think, in Leicester. And they forgot to send the bolts, and it had a lot of the panels and all the rest of it had to be put. They had quite a number of 6-inch nails on base, which luckily, so it was put together with 6-inch nails. So
these were
once it was built, they couldn't get the bolts in, sort of thing. It was a bit late by then. Mm. So it wasn't the best of bases.
So describe the faults as you saw them.
Well, the roof was already leaking. The heat from the hut, it had a cavern over it, nice cavern, but the heat from the hut was causing melt, going onto the roof and then dripping down through holes in the roof, well, not holes, but through the panels and that sort of thing.
Gaps,
yeah. And it wasn't very nice at all, really. They had strings coming down from wherever there was a leak, running down so that the water would run down the string and into a can, instead of just dripping everywhere.
So at least the bunks were dry, were they?
Sorry?
The bunks were dry, were they?
Well, the whole base was leaking, really, but the bunk room wasn't too bad, actually. But everywhere else was.
Mm-hmm. At this point, did you consider changing your mind?
No, much point, really. Ship had already gone, so... You had to make the best of it.
Yeah, but it was probably not as good as you expected.
Well, no, I didn't expect it to be raining inside the hut, no. But, I mean, they put guttering up and did all sort of things, channel the water away sort of thing. Then the next year they sent a butyl roofing felt down, which was were to put on the roof to stop it, really, but some of it got put up, but a lot of it didn't, because you couldn't really get up there.
What was your first... You were set to work as a mechanic on what?
Muskeg tractors, mainly.
Had you seen one before?
No, I've seen a picture.
Do you knew which end was which?
Oh, yeah, I knew that. Well, nothing complicated about it, really. It's just a small track vehicle with Chrysler industrial engine in it, you know. Steered by two handles. It's a bit awkward steering because there's no brake on it. It was just it was a brake, actually, there was no clutch on it. So as soon as you pull the handle back to break that track, you lost power. So it was a bit of a job to drive them, really.
So you couldn't steer if you were coasting?
Couldn't what?
Couldn't steer if you were coasting.
Oh, no, no. Well, there's no coasting, no. I mean, you're powered all the time, really.
Did you think they were fit for purpose, or...?
Well, they had to be, didn't they? That's all they'd got, really.
Yeah.
I think we had four, I think, at the time. Two new ones, that's right. Two new ones went in on the ship, on the Custer Dan, with us, which had been built in Totten, Southampton, with big cabs on, which we modified, we got to, hadn't we? That's part of being down there, is modify everything that comes in, you know.
To make it work.
Yeah.
So what did they have to do to the Mustangs?
Well, we put two bunks on the... The cabs were that big, it's just a waste of space, really. So we built two bunks behind the driver's seat, and the driver and his mate slept in there and used it to cook it in and all sorts of things. Just lived in the cab, rather than put a tent up.
Was that your idea?
Well, yeah.
Who did you have to... you had the idea quite quickly, and then who did you have to talk to about it before you could do it?
Well, nobody, really.
You were just autonomous.
I was the mechanic there, and that was it.
You just did it?
Well, yeah. They might have spoken to the base commander, but... He wasn't a mechanic, so he didn't know what was involved, really.
But it changed the way of working, didn't it? Because they would have to take a tent otherwise.
After what?
Did it change the way of working?
No, not really. No. Oh, yeah, in the field, yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. It meant you hadn't got to put a tent up and all the rest of it, yeah. It was a big help, really, yeah.
How reliable were they?
Well, very good, really, once we'd put... Modified them a bit, you know, made them better. I didn't have many breakdowns. Although, coming back, we were using these two new ones, the big cabs, and coming back, there was a squeak started, coming back from the Tottens, and they found out it was a wheel bearing on one of the, on one of the vehicles, so it was a matter of we had to strip the track off, and the wheel bearing had seized onto the shaft. So we were stuck there for a couple of days while we eventually managed to get the bearing off the shaft. Then we found out that the spares that we got were for the old vehicles, and they were different bearing to the new ones. Nobody told us the bearings had been changed. So it's a matter of changing... I don't know whether you know anything about a Mustang. It's got like eight wheels and the track running round them. So we had to take the middle wheels off and put them on the back to get the track running round. And it worked all right, but it was a bit of a pain at the time. Didn't know what we were going to do, really.
So you had to operate with less wheels?
Yeah,
wheels.
Yeah, it worked all right, yeah. Went along, yeah.
And all this was done in the field?
Oh, yeah. Pretty cold, I remember that, yeah.
Did he get a reputation for being able to fix things?
I don't know. I suppose so, yeah. Well, it's a matter of you've got to, haven't you, if you're there. You're the mechanic. I mean, you've got nobody else to rely on, really. He's got a diesel mech, but he's busy enough in his own jobs.
Mm. I mean, on generators and so on.
Yeah.
So what else did they have to fix? Did people bring things to you?
Oh, yeah, anything on base, really, in those days. I mean...
Such as?
There was just two mechanics, no electrician. Well, if they wanted anything modifying or making for the base sort of thing, came to us, you know.
Can you think of jobs you did?
Seemed to be quite a few plumbing jobs. I mean, we hadn't got any sophisticated plumbing at all, really. It was just a melt tank and pipes coming out of that. But they seemed to leak quite a lot, and we had to modify that. But there wasn't a lot of things on base that needed repairs like that. Repaired the stove and the kitchen, and but it was just jobs that needed doing, and somebody got to do them.
And you mentioned there's no electrician, so you had, did that fall?
We had a few electrical jobs to do, yeah.
Had you had any training in electrics?
Well, the obvious bits, yeah, you know. Had to put a plug on and things like that, yeah. But you soon learn when you get a few shocks, yeah.
Okay. Let's talk a bit more about the Musk case, because apart from maintaining them, you also did some field work in them as well.
Oh, yeah.
Is there a particularly memorable trip?
Well, the first trip, after we'd been there a couple of weeks, that because there was nobody on, well, there was one person on base who had got some field work, some field experience, rather, it was decided that it would be better if people that were going to go out in the field, like the drivers and the dog drivers and whatever, we did a trip into the, away from base, just to get some experience, really. And set off with two musk eggs, one dog team, I think, and one dog team, yeah. And it was just chaotic, really. I mean, we didn't know what we were doing. It was like somebody's circus sort of thing, you know. Everybody going off in different directions and whatever. But it was a good job we did that, because it showed up such a lot of problems with the muskegs. These things that had been built in Tottenham and Southampton, the engine sits in the centre of the chassis, and they'd insulated this chassis box with polystyrene and stuck it on the sides. Well, we found out as soon as that got wet in the field and then froze again, it'd get wet with the heat from the engine and drift going in, and the water then had, next time it thawed, had nowhere to go. They'd blocked up all the drain holes in the bottom and all sorts of things. So we spent quite a bit of time in the field chiseling this frozen polystyrene off the side of the engine well, sort of thing. Lying on your, well, the engine down there, and you've got to lie on the head. It's quite a job, that.
You were lying on the ice, were you?
Yeah. And they'd also fitted 6-bladed fans to the engines. I don't know why, because they were already fitted with 4-bladed fans. And it reversed the blow of the fan. And originally, it used to bring air in through the radiator, so there was any drift there, it stuck on the radiator and the snow sort of melted, and that was okay. But with the reverse and the thrust of the blow of the fan, it drew drift and air in through the sides of the engine cowling, and it just covered the complete engine. It's amazing, it was. There was ice all over it, even on the manifold, you know, with all the heat there. So I thought, well, the only thing we can do is take the fans off and cut a couple of blades off. So we cut 3 blades off, that's it, made it into a 3-bladed fan, which improved it a bit, but we're still drawing air in the wrong way, sort of thing. So good job we went out in the field then, because if these had showed up when we, it gave us an opportunity when we were back on base to do all these jobs before we went out in the field proper.
So this was a trial run, if you like.
It was a good idea, really. Yeah.
Were you surprised at how badly designed they were?
Well, I suppose in those days Bass had no technical people attached to them, and they're just lying on Crown agents, really. Engineers and Crown agents. They didn't know much about the Antarctic, I don't think.
You got the impression they'd never been there, did you?
Well, they hadn't been there, no. They were just buyers, really. The Crown agents in those days used to buy for all these different countries around the world, really.
So was there any way of feeding this information back to the Crown agents so they wouldn't make
sense? Oh, yeah, I think they got the message, yeah.
How did they get the message?
Well, through Bass HQ in London at the time.
But you'd write a report, would you?
Yeah, most people wrote a report of some description at the end of their year, sort of thing. But, I mean, there was nothing you could do until the end of the year. There was no... Well, you had a what they call a four-port and a month-port went back, but the radio was still on Morse code in those days. So you couldn't say much, really. As you might get the wrath of the radio up, you know. You give him this big spiel to type out.
You said it was chaotic, this first dummy run, this test run.
Yeah, we're only out about 3 weeks, like 2 weeks. But it's a good job it happened, really.
But was it chaotic in more than just technical terms? Is it chaotic in human terms as well?
Well, the two lads with the dogs, yeah. One bent down to, they'd stopped, and one bent down to do something with his skis, and the other did something at the same time, and the dogs went. And they chased them for about 6 miles before they caught them up, and they'd only stopped because they were having a fight. So that was a bit chaotic, really. They weren't very pleased about that. But, I mean, that taught them you don't both leave the dogs, you know, without one of you at least keeping an eye on them, yeah.
So it sounds like there was a lot of inexperience.
Well, there was, yeah. Nobody had been out in the field before now. Just one person.
There's only one person doing the second time?
Well, yeah, doing from the previous year, yeah.
Right. So it sounds like they were ill-prepared then.
Well, I don't know. You go on base and... well, I don't know, really. I don't say they were ill-prepared, no. It just the way it happened, really.
Did it get better over the years?
Oh, yeah, had to, didn't it? Yeah, it got better, yeah, got a lot better. We had people with more experience there. And once you've done 1 year, you know, well, you think you know it all, but obviously you don't. But, and you teach the people coming in then, the second year.
So having modified your muskegs and realise how to do this, all this. There was an expedition, wasn't there? I may have got this wrong, but was it to Totten's?
Totten's, yeah.
So you named part of the Antarctic after the company in...
No. That was just a coincidence, actually.
Right.
This firm in Southampton named Totten Engineering. Although I think must have been some tie-up with the Antarctic, because they named these two vehicles Stankham and Wills. Well, Stankham Wills is a chronometry, chronometry, yeah, something like that, which is higher up than Halley Bay, sort of thing, along the coast. So somebody must have known something, but the Totten name was just a coincidence, really. Yeah.
So what do you remember that first long trip, your first proper experience of the Antarctic away from base?
Well, it was 240 miles to the nearest mountains, which were the Tottens, from base. We had no compasses or anything to... we had compasses, but you couldn't set them up in the vehicle, because as soon as you started, they were sitting on top of the axle. And as soon as you started and the axle started turning, then the compass went. You couldn't fix them anywhere else, really.
So the axle was generating electrical...
Yeah, well, not electrical, but...
Vibratory.
Yeah. So we had to set up a system on the vehicle. We put a mirror on the front windscreen with a line on it. And welded a piece of rod onto the exhaust pipe, which was behind the vehicle, behind the back window. And the driver looked through the mirror, sighted the line up on the mirror onto the line on the exhaust pipe, and then onto the following vehicle, went in, travelled in the tracks of the first vehicle. So to start with, your spare man went outside and set the muskeg up with a compass, sighting along it, so that he was running on the bearing. So that, and then the second...
You're pointing it in the right direction.
Yeah, well, he needed to be, yeah. And the second vehicle went in the exact tracks of the first vehicle and stayed about 30 yards behind. So if the driver of the first one looked through the mirror, sighted on the exhaust pipe and on the back vehicle, they could more or less drive straight line.
Is that your idea?
Well, it's sort of, not mine particularly, no. Sort of accumulated, you know.
But it's a good example of problem solving, isn't it?
Well, yeah. Well, we had to do something, really, yeah. But, I mean, once you got going, we put a flag in every 2 miles. We called a glacial flag and measured it so they could measure it again next time they went past for accumulation, find out what accumulation was on that particular area sort of thing. And because the surface is up and down, you could look back, sight back, and you could perhaps see one or two flags, and you could move your bearing about and just keep a straight line sort of thing. Mm. Yeah, it worked out very well, actually, yeah. And once we could see the bit, we got within about 100, no, less than that, about 70 miles or so, you could see the mountains, so you could aim for them, so that was a bit easier.
Was that something which was corrected in the second season, that system? Did the compasses work second year?
No, the route was already in, so that was okay. Once the route was in, with a flag every 2 miles, made life a lot easier. You could just stay on the route and go.
So that was the only survey work you were doing, was those routes to the mountains?
We had surveyors with us, and we put those in the mountains. They stayed in the mountains with geologists for 4 months, I think it was.
Oh, right, okay. And you had to go...
We came back for resupply, then did another trip.
Were you laying depots as well?
Yeah, there was one already put in. They'd put one in the previous year at 80 miles from base. So that was used. Depot of fuel and rations.
There was a chap called Neville Mann.
Yeah.
In your first year. What happened to him?
They were... There was two of them training dogs. They had small... They'd cut a mordine down. Not a mordine. A dog sledge down. And they were training pups, actually. And they put... harnessed them up to his smaller sledge and put a bit of weight on it too. And they were going from the base down the ramp onto the sea ice and along about a mile and a half, and up another ramp back onto the top of the cliff and back to base sort of thing. And they were usually running together, but this particular day they both set off together, but when they got down on the sea ice, it was blowing quite drifting quite a lot, and they missed one another. And the other chap, I forget his name now, he came back to base expecting that Nev already would be there or would be not far behind him sort of thing. But he never turned up, so he went back onto sea ice but decided it was... The wind had got up quite a lot and it wasn't safe to go down there. So he went along the top of the cliff to the other ramp and couldn't see anything. So he came back to base again, so they decided that they'd mount a rescue party. So they got a muskeg and went down to the cliff top. And by the time they got down there, the sea ice had all gone out. And they looked around and couldn't see any signs of dogs or sledges or Nev or anybody else sort of thing. So came back to base and the wind got up then and we couldn't get back down to the cliffs for another 2 days. Just wasn't safe to go anywhere. So after the 2 days, after the wind dropped down a bit, they went down again and did a big search along the top of the cliffs in case they managed to get up and was, you know, down somewhere. But we never found anything. So it was quite tragic, really.
He was never seen again.
Sorry?
He was never seen again.
No. Nor the dogs, nor anything. So, not the base.
What was the theory? What did you assume had happened to him?
Well, the ice had just broken up and I don't know, he'd either gone with it or gone through it or whatever.
Were there any lessons learned from that?
Yeah, don't go on a sea ice if it's blowing. No, not really. I mean, they were just taking a chance by going down on the sea ice when it was blowing, really. Although it got worse as they were down there. It wasn't too bad when they left base. It was, quite tragic.
Was there any change of working pattern as a result of that? Did the base commander change the way that
Well, I mean, the sea ice had gone, so they certainly didn't go down there, no. Mm. And it took another month before it formed again. Not really, no. You just take more precautions, you know.
And this was this wasn't really a serious expedition, was it?
No. You just training, just running along the sea ice and back again. Mm. But it's something that had to be done, sort of thing.
What was the? How long did the mood last back at base? Did you go for weeks?
Yeah, I suppose. Yeah, I suppose it did, really, yeah. They built a monument to him and things like that, and we had a service and built a monument on a sledge so it could be moved, because with everything down there, you build it on the snow, then it just gets covered up. So we had a small sledge there, which they built this monument of from bricks that were spare down there, and that's been going for years and years and years, really. Have you seen that?
Still there,
yeah.
With more names on.
Yeah, there is, actually, yeah.
More names have been added to it.
Yeah.
So this was a bit of a little lesson for you, was it, in terms of how dangerous the Antarctic could be?
Well, I suppose so, yeah. Before anybody had gone out in the field, really, it was in the autumn time. He was a surveyor. So it pulled the base together a bit, really, yeah.
In what way? You mean just shared loss?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Okay. You were there through the summer? The Antarctic summer, and then the winter closing again.
Yeah.
How did your life pattern change from summer to winter?
Well, obviously you can't go out as much. It's dark outside. And we had quite a lot of work to do, really, in the garage, doing these, getting these two muskegs ready for the field again. So we had the winter months to prepare them, because we wouldn't be going out until the following September, I think, September the 10th. We decided there was enough light to travel. We needed about 8 hours, really, before it was worth travelling. So we were kept quite busy in the workshop, getting these vehicles ready, really.
Did you have all the spares you needed, or were you having to create them?
Well, we had a lot of spares, but there was a lot of the old spares wouldn't fit the new vehicle, so although we didn't find that out till later.
So, I mean, to manufacture parts, were you?
Well, not really, no. No, we hadn't got... we'd got a small lathe, but it was only a small thing. We couldn't make anything of any size, sort of thing. But a lot of it was just welding and that sort of thing.
What about social life in the winter? Presumably there was more time for socialising, partying?
Well, yeah, we had a... They decided we'd have a party each month for the people who had a birthday that month, sort of thing. So that was quite a night, yeah.
Can you describe it?
Well, it was a big... it was decided that whoever's birthday it would have to make a speech, which wasn't very good. And it was a big meal put on. We had, in those days, they had party boxes. I don't know whether they had 12 or not. We have 12.
There's 12 man rations in a
party. Well, one a month, which consisted of various bits and pieces, extra rations and things that you wouldn't normally have on base. And we had extra beer and spirits.
Port and sherry in the party box as well.
That's right, yeah.
Port and sherry.
Yeah.
Yeah, and boxes of biscuits and stuff like that, which all made the party go quite well, really, yeah.
So you must have had a birthday down there.
Yeah, May, yeah.
In the middle of winter?
Well, no, not middle winter. Well, yeah.
Early winter.
Middle of winter's 21st of June, yeah. And that was a big celebration as well, Midwinter's Day. Which went on for a few days, yeah.
What happened? Tell me about that. Was there a party box marked Midwinter's Day?
No, I think they just took some of the other stuff out, I think. Because during the summer you didn't party too much.
Yeah. Were there, people were there, off base. Were there any strange ceremonies attached to any of this?
No, not really, no. No, I can't. No, I don't think so.
Oh, okay. Just basically men getting drunk, was it?
Well, yes, and I suppose it was really, yeah. You had a bit of a sing song if anyone could play an instrument, sort of thing.
You had your midwinter presents?
Yeah, that was a thing as well, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
The presents, tell me about those. That's.
Anyway, we had them the first year, actually. We certainly had them the second time. Yeah, the base commander, when he was before he went down, he was working in the office, got in touch with all the relatives, the parents of the people that were down there, and or going down there, and said, would they send a small present of some description, you know, what they thought was the person would like or not like. And he kept them until Midwinter's Day. Nobody else knew about them at all, really. And then he brought them out and said, oh, there's presents here from your parents and relatives and whatever. Yeah. It's quite a nice surprise, really. Yeah.
Were you ever lonely or homesick?
No, not really. No. Well, I wasn't. I mean, other people might have been. I can't remember being homesick now.
Yeah.
I'd been away from home quite a bit beforehand, sort of thing.
And did you have to do any cooking? Were you on rota?
Yeah, on the rota, yeah.
What were your culinary skills like?
Not too good.
Is that what people tell you?
Spaghetti bolognese and stuff like that, you know. I wasn't a great cook, really. But we had a different system there. We had different people were on... You know about gash, two gash hands and a cook for that day, sort of thing. The cooks had a day off on Sunday, didn't they? So somebody was picked to do the Sunday cooking, and there's quite a lot of volunteers, really. So if you didn't want to do it, then you could get out of it, you know.
Hey.
I wasn't too keen on it, actually.
For those first two winters down south, tell me about one or two of the characters you remember who stick in your memory.
Well, Barry, the diesel mate. He was an Australian, actually, about 6'4".
Barry.
Yeah, I can't pronounce his name, actually.
All right.
It's a name about this long German origin. Have a look in the...
We'll look at that.
Yeah. And he was quite a character, really. He was on a... doing a gap year in Europe, actually, at the time of when he was recruited. And he was happened to be in London and saw this advert for... this before I saw mine, actually, for diesel mechanics and electricians and things like that. And he applied for this job and got an interview, and they said they would take him, but they had to get special permission from the Commonwealth Office to take this Australian, the first time they had anybody from nothing, not from UK sort of thing. Anyway, he went down, and typical Australian, you know, he hadn't... he had advice to take it in those days, you had advice to take a suit with you, and, well, shirt and ties and things like that. He tended to dress up on a Saturday night on the ship on the way down. And also to take a suit, because in those days you'd be interviewed by How do you pronounce it?
Krachenbühl.
Yeah, something like that.
Krachenbühl.
Be interviewed by the what was the
Governor of Stanley?
Governor of Stanley, yeah, sorry.
That's all right.
Yeah, Governor of Stanley. And everybody had to dress up and go and meet him there, and you had about a quarter of an hour or so with him, and he asked you where you come from and all the rest of it, you know, all these silly things they ask you. And then at night they had a cocktail party for all the ship, and he went up there and drunk as many gins as he could, sort of thing. We were quite weak, actually, but as the years progressed, they got stronger as you got to know people, you know. And he went up there for his interview. He hadn't got a suit, he hadn't got a decent shirt, he hadn't got a tie, and people around the ship were kitting him out. He bought somebody's suit, somebody's jacket, somebody's tie, and walked in there and dressed up like this, said, "Hi, Governor." Typical Australian, you know. Well, he went down very well, actually. They became quite good friends, I think. Yeah.
You came back home for a couple of years, didn't you? You did your first 2 years in...
Oh, yeah, sorry, yeah. Yeah, did 2.5 years down there, then came back, yeah.
So what happened when you got back? What were you doing? Did you leave Bass at that point?
Yeah, for a time, yeah, about 12 months, I think. I went back to the same job I had before. And then I applied to go down again. And I was accepted. And they said, "Do you fancy coming and working in the office for a time?" So I went down to London and worked in the office for a time. And then... doing various things, office work and doing ordering and checking engineering indents and things like that. And then went down again for a second time.
How have things changed in the interim, Harry?
Well, they built a new base.
Number two?
Yeah, Grillage Village it's called, yeah.
Grillage Village?
Grillage Village, yeah, because it was laid on steel grillage and then timbers on top.
Was it
finished? In fact, they started building that when in the first year, in right. the 63 year. No, they hadn't. Sorry, I'm getting the years mixed up. Sorry.
Okay, that's fine.
It was the 67 year. Yeah, they started building that year, yeah. Yeah.
Were you involved in building it?
Yeah, to a certain extent, yeah. The building team went down. About six builders, I think, went down, and they were more involved in than we were, really. They built it about 2.5 miles inland from the base we were living in. So once they got a couple of huts up there, the builders moved up there then. I think till then they'd been living on a ship, actually, yeah. Two ships went down.
And but it was finished whilst you were there?
Well, the outer skins were put up and all the rest of it, yeah, but there's a lot of work inside the base to be finished. And it wasn't until about halfway through the following year that the old base moved up entirely to the new one, sort of thing.
So describe that process to me. What were the great advantages of Halley 2 over Halley 1? Obviously the lack of drips, I trust.
Yeah, it wasn't raining inside, no. It had a lot better accommodation. The bunk rooms were bigger. Had a big lounge. And there's quite a lot of people there, actually. There was 30-odd. First year, there was 24. And the second year, and that's right, there was 40 people. But the third time, they were running two bases, sort of thing. But then when everybody moved up to the newly finished base, there was 40 people on base, yeah.
Was it cosy?
Yeah, it was quite good, actually, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Was an improvement in your workshop?
Yeah, bigger, better, yeah.
Had you been involved in ordering for the workshop?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So back in London, you were feathering your nest down south.
That's right, yeah. But there was a limit on what you could, how much you could spend, so on, you know.
What did you order that was a step forward for the new workshops?
Well, more spares. I mean, and that year as well, the two new IHs were going down for the first time.
The IH?
IHs, International Harvesters.
Which tractors. Tractors?
Yeah. So we had to order spares for them as well. So that was new to the base, yeah.
Tell me about those. Were they very different from the Mustangs?
Oh, yeah, bigger, heavier, about 7 ton, actually, each one. Slower, although the Mustangs weren't very fast when they were out in the sea, out on the Bondu. But these could pull a heavier load, and they also had a blade on the front, a bulldozing blade, and a big winch on the back.
So they were better in many respects, were they?
Yeah, but they weren't as easy to drive as the Mustangs, really, now.
Were they easier to maintain?
Well, yeah, because they were heavier and bigger, things didn't wear out as quickly, sort of thing. But we did have a few problems with them, really. Had tracks on some of the tracks. They had very wide tracks on them. And quite heavy, really, for the machine. And on the tractor, they got big springs, rebound springs, and they tended to break, which is quite a job to replace them, really. I mean, spitting all the track out and the idler wheel and various things. It's just a heavier job, really.
But they were more reliable in the field?
Yeah, I suppose so, yeah, yeah, yeah.
You sound doubtful about that.
Well, they were more reliable. We didn't, when we took them out to the field, we had no problems with them at all, really.
Whilst you've been back in the UK, there'd been a tragedy with a Mustang when going down into a ravine, a crevasse, and I think three men were lost.
That's right, yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
You addressed this problem when you got back, did you?
Yeah, I knew. Two of them. I actually worked in London office with them, really. Di Wild, who was a geologist, yeah. And a doctor. Yeah, it was quite a tragedy, actually, yeah.
But you were able to do something about it for the future?
Oh, you mean as far as the vehicles are concerned?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, we thought about it and wondered what we could do. It seemed that if a Mustang broke into a crevasse, it usually went 3/4 of the way across and then went backwards, or the weight was at the back and dropped in that way.
A rear first?
Yeah, and because the Mustang wasn't very high, sort of thing, off the ground, it was only about 3 foot, 3 foot 6 something. So it would slide down a smallish crevasse once it started going, you know. So we wondered if we could extend the volume of the vehicle, sort of thing.
Don't worry.
Volume of the vehicle. So there's a lot of scaffold tube on base that had been used in the erection of the new base. So we decided to build a a frame round the back of the vehicle to extend the size of it, really, not put much more weight on it, but to extend the size of it, and that in fact did save one vehicle from going down. Yeah.
So you're making a kind of a frame, rather like a roll bar.
It's up there, look on that picture.
Oh yes.
So just to extend the size of it, really.
Yeah. So it would require a bigger crevasse for it to go.
Yeah, down. That's right. Yeah, yeah, with a bit of luck. Yeah, that's and it did actually save one. Yeah. So, and we also by that time we got bigger, better, and bigger sledges. We designed a bigger sledge to go behind the muskegs. Previous, we were using mortarms, which were all wood sledge. And we designed one which had more steel in it, a Tabascargo sledge, and it had a steel frame right at the front. So we put crossed ropes, wires, from the front of the sledge to the back of the muskeg, so that would help if the muskeg went down. Because when the lads were lost, the A-frame, which attached the sledge to the muskeg, broke, and if that had held, it would have held the muskeg up.
Yes.
But so we decided to put these extra cross wires on, in the hope that if anything did happen, then that would also keep it on the surface. Yeah.
These modifications that you made? You were constantly being inventive, it seems to me.
Well, yeah. Go down and look at the vehicle and stand there and think, what the hell can I do now? So,
you know. Well, my next question was, did you feel you were being stretched as an engineer?
No.
Was it all fairly obvious?
Nobody was saying do something or anything, you know. It was just to try and make them safe for vehicle, really.
Yeah. So it was all routine, obvious things to do?
Well, it was when you saw what had happened and why it had happened, yeah.
So you didn't have sleepless nights thinking how to sleep?
No. Didn't have many long nights to sleep and dream, so, you know.
There was a trip out to reach the Shackletons, wasn't there, which I think you were involved in a big way?
Yeah, that was later on. That was in 68, yeah.
Yeah. Tell me about that. What was the point?
Well, the previous year, 67, they'd done a big, the dogs had been out with the muskegs to another mountain range, which I forget the name of at the moment.
Theron.
Theron's, okay.
That's right. And it was decided then that we'd try and get to the Shackleton Mountains, which were the next range further on, which involved going up the Schlesinger Glacier, which was from the Theron's to the... But we had four dog teams out at the time, and they were wrecking further on, sort of thing, and they would go so far then turn in to try and get... There's a big crevassed area running alongside the mountain range, and each time they were turned back, it was just impossible to get through it. So they would go on further and further. We were following them up slowly with the muskegs. Up the Schlesinger Glacier, which is quite a climb actually, we had to double head, which means put two muskegs, one towing the other one, and one sledge behind. So that took us some time actually. We'd go so far, 100 miles, and then have to go back for the other sledge and carry on again. In the meantime, they were wrecking further and further on. They got to a point where we had to decide whether, well, we had to make a decision. We couldn't go much further because we were running out of fuel. We had to think of fuel going back. So the Muskets came back with two of the dog teams, and we left two dog teams in the mountains to try and find a route through. And they found a route. As it was, we'd come from the Therons. We'd gone direct from the Therons from the crossing point onto the Inland Ice. But then we'd gone onto the Shackletons, but they decided that if we put a line in straight from the crossing point to where they'd terminated and started back, didn't need to go around the Therons at all. We could save a few, 100 miles or so. So I thought that was put in. But then we got a message from London to say that there wouldn't be any more travel the following year. The Americans had decided that they would fly in two dog teams from Halley Bay into the Shackleton Mounties because they were doing some work out there as well. And there'd be no need for us to go. So there's a lot of to-ing and fro-ing with the telexes and things, and more or less said that, what are we going to do then, sort of thing, where are we going? And Sir Vivian, in his wisdom, he was still director then, said that it would be a good idea if we had depots along the route so that if anything happened to the aeroplane or anything else and the Yanks couldn't get in, he didn't trust the Yanks too much, I don't think, they couldn't get in and pick the dog teams up when they'd finished and they had to come back, and we needed depots in. So we decided that we would go to the Shackletons after all. So we put together two Muskegs, two IHs. It's the first time the IHs had been out in the field, really. And six people went out. We had a full load of 32 tonnes, or 29 tonnes, sorry, 29 tonnes of various things. It was the longest unsupported trip that Bass had ever done. And
you went, did you?
Yeah, I went, yeah. I needed to go. Yes, I went, yeah. It had, there's five of us went up to, yeah. It was a fantastic trip, yeah. And we eventually got to Shackleton Range, yeah.
Were they beautiful, the mountains?
It's beautiful to see it for the first time, yeah, as you come over this ridge. The ground's undulating, and eventually you come to a height and you can see it in the distance, I need something to... sorry.
Let's take a pause, shall we?